Greetings, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Patty James, Vice Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and Chair of this program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. John Dearborn, MD. Dr. Dearborn is the Medical Director of the Institute for Joint Restoration and Research, housed at Washington Hospital in Fremont, California. Dr. Dearborn is a Bay Area native and completed his undergraduate degrees at Stanford University. He spent the next 9 years at UCSF, completing his medical degree, internship, and residency in orthopedic surgery. He was selected for a one-year fellowship in joint replacement surgery in the Harvard Medical School program at Massachusetts General Hospital and then began practice in 1997. He partnered with the hospital to build what has become one of the largest joint replacement programs in the country. While earning the highest outcome marks from independent evaluators such as Health Grades and Consumer Reports. The clinical research portion of the Institute tracks the results of over 15,000 replacement surgeries, and their data has been presented all over the world. His efficient yet compassionate approach to healthcare delivery has been documented in numerous news segments, articles, and a recent book. Despite the attention his work has gained, he considered his greatest achievements to be his 26-year marriage to his wife, Danielle, and his two children, Laurel and Noah. Welcome, Dr. Dearborn.
Thanks for your attention. Just a few simple words about me. It sounds like I already had a very generous introduction, so I'll be brief. I have been in practice 20 years now, and I've got a big academic background, but made an intentional choice to not go into academics, and we can get into that a little bit during the Q&A maybe. I'm very privileged to be involved with the Institute for Joint Restoration and Research. I was asked by Patty in preparation for this, whether I would be selling a book that maybe I had written, and I haven't written any books, but these are three that I wish that I had written. books that I read several years ago, actually, and they helped myself and our core team at the Institute, formerly the Center for Joint Replacement, come up with some of our processes and certainly raise the value of teamwork, which is very important to our program. So let me give you just a quick outline of what we're going to do here tonight, or what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to give you, certainly from my perspective, what the state of our healthcare problem is, some insights possibly into how we got here. I'll certainly be talking a lot about what our program has done that has worked, and I'm hoping that from there I'll be able to share some things that may work for the rest of medicine, and we'd welcome questions and discussion at the end. So why did I choose the term navigating? Well, obviously, we're here in this great port city, but the sense of navigating, we're on a boat, we're moving forward together, so we're all in this together. Certainly, when you're navigating on the seas, you're going to expect waves to be happening, and we're certainly facing a lot of waves in healthcare today. And when you're out on the ocean, storms, bigger waves are bound to come, and we've weathered some, and there's some ahead. And navigating is also a verb. We are all part of this process, and we need to be working on navigating together. We should not be passive agents in the healthcare that we receive and in the healthcare changes to come. I think passivity is going to be dangerous for the future. Who am I to give any advice related to this? As was mentioned before, I have a private practice experience, but a lot of academic exposure. I don't have any particular axe to grind where I'm going to drag somebody down and say they're not doing it right or whatever. So I'm going to be relatively objective here. We've been very successful steering a program through major obstacles. So we've got a track record of some success, which hopefully will add weight to my comments. And I'll share, I'm also a healthcare consumer as well as a provider. I've had my share of issues which may come up here today. So I've experienced healthcare in the best of situations and some that weren't so good. So I can share on both of those fronts. I pulled this definition for crisis off of dictionary.com. Definition number one, a stage in a sequence of events at which a trend of all future events, especially for the better or for worse, is determined, a turning point. And that's where I feel like we are right now in our healthcare for a lot of reasons. Medicare is a big piece of that, but I think it hits all areas of medicine. I also like definition number five, the point in a player's story at which hostile elements are most tensely opposed to each other. And we're going to talk as I go about elements that would look like they are against each other, making the situation more difficult and making decisions harder to come to. And we'll talk about maybe what to do about those opposed views. When we're talking about a crisis, it implies that maybe things used to be good and now they're not. And I guess I would ask the question whether healthcare delivery has ever been smooth. And we'll look back at the 20th century, long before I was born, at the series of hurdles that we've covered already. And we didn't have penicillin until late in the 1920s. So before that, we had real trouble managing infections. During the Great Depression, which my parents grew up in, the biggest issue was paying for medical bills. During the 1940s, President Truman had pushed for a national healthcare system, but was not able to get it through during his presidency. So a hurdle there, which he could not leap over. We had the polio vaccine in the 1950s. So before that, polio was a big problem, but we had a leap there that was successful. And certainly in the 60s, Medicare was signed into law. So there's been a lot of things happening, which hopefully have smoothed the process. But we've had some progress since then. It looks like more hurdles. Since Medicare was instituted in the mid-1960s, we've had a tremendous advance, obviously, in medical technology and information, much of which has extended the life of Americans, which is fantastic. But on the other side of it, now we have a lot more older people to take care of, and our technology is becoming more expensive. So it's created some problems while solving others. I pulled some data from the internet looking at Americans that are age 65 or older going through the years. So you can see in 1880, we only had 1.7 million Americans that were 65 or older. And in 2000, we had 34.9 million. Life expectancy for individuals who are going to live until Social Security age is also an important thing to look at. And we see that life expectancy obviously is increasing. 1990, we're at 72 years for a man and 83 and change for a woman. But interestingly, for patients who survived to Medicare age, the number of years that they live once hitting that age hasn't changed as much. And that's because the change in life expectancy, a big piece of that is deaths during childhood, deaths during the early car eras where people got in crashes. So a lot of people didn't survive till 65 because they had an injury or something else. So I think when you're looking at healthcare economics, it's probably better to look at once you're 65, how long are you going to be around after that? And you can see the numbers haven't changed as dramatically as life expectancy. That Medicare population, some of you are in that population here. The Medicare population isn't all that healthy either. You can see that 2/3 of them have 3 or more chronic conditions. Income is an issue. Some of them at the bottom you can see are in long-term care facilities already. So sort of outlined our crisis, and I guess I would ask the question, do you feel safer now that that our crisis really looks more like a tidal wave? It's a sum of a lot of things that have been that we've been jumping over along the way, but now we're facing something a little bit bigger coming. So we'll get into the state of the problem, and I want to talk from the patient perspective, which you all can speak to. And I want to talk from the physician perspective, which I'll spend more time on since most of you are not physicians. Incidentally, do I have any physicians in the audience? Okay. Well, I have 2 physicians in the audience. Thank you for being here. Looking from the patient perspective, we won't unpack these a lot, but during the Q&A, maybe we will a little bit more. We have some big sources of pressure from the patient perspective. And these are things that I hear from my patients routinely, so I'll just go through them. Many of them have lost or are losing their primary care physician. Their primary care physician may be going into a concierge practice, for example, or they may no longer accept the insurance plan that the patient has. So that's a big piece. For patients who aren't losing their doctor, they may be noticing they can't access that doctor as easily. It takes longer for phone calls to be returned. There are drop balls happening. Lab tests to get ordered don't get followed up on. Premiums for healthcare insurance are going up. Some of our patients have a lot of concerns about what's happening with Medicare, whether their knee replacement that they need is going to be approved by Medicare, whether 5 years from now it will be. Maybe they should get it done now. A lot of concerns about Medicare coverage, and these concerns ultimately lead to dissatisfaction on behalf of the patients and a sense that the system is against me. And we're going to see this from the physician side as well. The sources of pressure are similar. The first that I'll talk about is economic, and it's really driven by declining reimbursement from Medicare and from other carriers, and we'll talk about why that is. The second major source of pressure is the expanding knowledge base. Technology is advancing. There's a lot more to know in order to stay current and to keep our patients safe. And physicians are concerned about doing the right thing and making the right diagnosis. And with having to know more, there's added pressure that physicians are feeling, and certainly there can be some medical legal implications of not being up to date on some of the latest treatments. So I guess at this point I'll ask if we have a health economist in the crowd, because we're going to talk about Medicare, and do I have a health economist here? Okay, that's good and bad. It's good in that I probably won't get heckled because I'm saying something that's not true, but it's bad during the discussion time. We won't find out what the truth really is. So let's move onward. Just taking us back through a brief Medicare history, in 1966, it starts after Johnson signs it into law in 1965. There are rapid signups that happen. 19 million people in the first year sign up for Medicare, and the budget is $10 billion in that first year. The primary tenets of Medicare was coverage for everybody over 65, that the government would not interfere in any way with the practice of medicine. It was a fee-for-service system. And it was funded by the payroll tax divided between the employer and the employee. From 1972 onward, it changed, especially beginning in 72 when President Nixon added disabled people under 65 and renal failure patients to that group under Medicare. So it instantly increased the number of people who were eligible for Medicare and the cost, especially for the renal failure side. In 1967, the House Ways and Means Committee made a cost projection that in 1990, Medicare would cost a total of $12 billion. The actual cost in 1990 was $98 billion. DRGs, or diagnostic-related groups, were introduced in... the DRGs, which were diagnostic-related groups, introduced in the 1980s, those were designed to control the costs for hospitalization. So for a given procedure like a hip replacement or a knee replacement, that had a particular code, and Medicare would say, well, that procedure to fix that is worth this much money. No matter how much the hospital spent, mostly that's true, no matter how much the hospital spent, the hospital only get paid that certain amount of money. And that, unfortunately, that certain amount of money has remained relatively fixed since the 1980s. I'll tell you, for a hip replacement, it's about $15,000. Unless there's major complications or the patient ends up in the ICU, it's about $15,000. The DRGs did not affect post-discharge costs for a hip replacement or a knee replacement. It didn't affect physical therapy or post-op medications or things like that. It was purely to control the hospital cost. In 1995, the Medicare officials warned that by 2001, Medicare would not have enough money to cover hospitalization. The Balanced Budget Act happened in 1997, which further cut reimbursements, and it led to a series of reduction, or at least planned reductions, in physician reimbursement for certain surgical procedures. Often those reductions didn't actually happen. At the last hour, Congress would approve a pot of money to help cover that, what was going to be a decrease in reimbursement. And then the next time we were up for a decrease, that decrease would be even a larger percentage. So there was one year where we were told that as of January 1, we're going to be paid 30% less for doing the same operation, which is a pretty scary thing to be living under as a physician. So it creates a lot of pressure. Lastly, the Affordable Care Act, 2010, additional standards created, essentially creating a pay-for-performance situation where Medicare can withhold money, withhold reimbursement if certain performance indicators are not met. And those are indicators that are picked by Medicare, not necessarily based in science. The Medicare tax was increased for income for households making more than $200,000 a year, an additional 0.9% on top of the payroll tax that already existed. I think directly one of the results of that increased tax and the plan and the expected decreased reimbursement that we're going to be paid because from the paper for performance led to improved solvency projections for Medicare. So here are the solvency projections starting in 2005 and going to 2016. So in 2005, the projection was that Medicare would be out of money in 2020. So at the bottom in 2016, it's now 2028. It was better last year than it was this year. So a little scary, especially for someone like me. I'm 50 years old, be 51 in a couple months. I'll be ready for Medicare by then, and at least the projections are that Medicare money won't be around unless something dramatic happens. Here's Medicare's as a share of the federal budget for 2015. You can see it's 15% of our entire federal budget, about the same as defense. When you look at the funding for Medicare, the second bar from the left is Part A. That's your hospitalization costs. And you can see that 88% of that is coming from your payroll taxes. So the vast majority of that is funded by payroll taxes. This was a chart from the Kaiser family's data showing the actual and projected net Medicare spending from 2010 to 2026. And you can see it's a steady upward expenditure, which is part of why the projection for 2028 is so bleak. So in summary, on the reimbursement side, Medicare reimbursement for surgery is actually about 20% less than it was 20 years ago because of all those changes, especially the Balanced Budget Act. Private insurers typically have reduced their payments in kind, and so for most private insurers, they pay about the same as Medicare for all the different procedures that we do. That's despite the fact that private insurers have consistently been raising premiums. In fact, we looked since 2010 for our employees of our corporation, the premiums have gone up by 60%. So the insurers are paying less for care, but getting more from the subscribers. I found this graph of the insurance stock prices. The dip that you see there obviously is the crash of 2009. The top curve is Aetna. The second curve is United Health. The third curve is Anthem Blue Cross. And this is how the market did. So you can see that compared to before the crash, the insurance companies are doing beautifully, far better than the market. So the next step for Medicare, which started this year, it won't be enforced until next year, is what's called the bundled payment program, which is going to attack the post-discharge expenditures. I mentioned that the DRGs affected just the in-hospital costs for procedures like joint replacement. The bundled payment program will trim the post-discharge costs. And essentially what is going to happen is hospitals are going to be pitted against other hospitals in terms of being the lowest in terms of post-discharge costs. And if a hospital is not able to be within a certain range or beat the regional bundle price that Medicare assigns, the hospital will owe Medicare money. On the flip side, if a hospital is able to do a joint replacement, including the post-discharge expenditures, and do it for less than the regional bundle price, we'll get money back at the end of the year. So programs like ours that are already very efficient, we're actually going to do okay under bundled payment. But hospitals that are not as efficient, ones that are not even inherently efficient, such as academic centers, are going to have trouble. So ultimately, the bundled payment effect is going to have some good and bad and some ugly effects. I'll start with the bad, in that the original tenet of Medicare, one of the big four, was that the government was not going to interfere with healthcare delivery. And in this particular case with the bundled payments, they're directly interfering with the practice of medicine because they're saying, well, you know, that that program down the road sends their patients home rather than to skilled nursing facilities, so you need to do the same, or we're going to take money from you at the end of the year. So, and you guys have to figure out how to do it, but essentially Medicare is going to say, well, here are the best practices, you need to follow them, and best practice, according to the bundled payment program, is the least expensive practice, not necessarily providing the best outcome. So it's a little sketchy in my view. The good, of course, is ongoing cost containment, because there are some programs that aren't as efficient and they should become more efficient. There are some programs that don't have the structured postoperative care, or maybe they're not paying as close attention to patient selection as they could. And so that programs like this will help that process. The ugly, though, in this is that I expect we're going to see cherry picking. What I mean by that is, if you have a patient who you think is going to be more costly to deliver a particular procedure for, maybe a patient who's got renal failure or a patient with a history of GI bleeding or alcoholism, and you think that they may have a complication that will increase the cost of their individual care beyond the average bundle price, you may see that patient shipped off to a tertiary care center, and you may see some excuses like, oh gosh, you know, you're complicated and you're better done in a tertiary care center, which of course isn't really true. So I'm concerned we're going to see that. So we're going to see some shifting of patients, which is very unfortunate. There are some programs that may cut certain services just because they're costly, rather than looking at the pros and cons of those services and whether or not they're cost effective. So I'm concerned about what's going to happen. So we've covered the economic side pretty well. I figured I would share with you the second physician pressure, which is that knowledge base issue and the pressure to keep up to date or, like me, become a super specialist. So I'll share with you a riddle first. What do you call two orthopedic doctors reading an EKG? And the answer is a double-blind study. So we orthopedists took a beating during our residency training from the internal medicine doctors. And you'll be happy to know that your typical orthopedist is as strong as an ox, but only twice as smart. Our internists did have a lot they have to learn. This is was the internal medicine Bible when I was in training, Harrison's Principles of Internal Medicine. This book is nearly 5 inches thick. It has such a long table of contents that they have to have an abbreviated contents at the beginning because the table of contents is too long. There's 2,200 pages, but then when you include the indexes and the appendices, it's actually over 2,400 pages long. They do have, I'd be a little nervous about having any of the conditions that you see there because they're right at the end of the book. So, but a lot of the internists, they do get to the end of the book. There is a section on arthritis you see here. There's actually 4 pages from 1475 to 1479 on arthritis, which is helpful to know that. And this is the section, and the largest paragraph in that section is on the epidemiology of osteoarthritis. They do have a section on the hip, which you can see is about 12 lines. And the problem is when you get to the end, to the treatment of hip osteoarthritis, it says, call an orthopedic surgeon. So Yeah, and these books are so thick and unwieldy that often we'll carry these smaller manuals around. This is one that I carried around in my pocket when I was an intern. It was a more condensed version of a book like Harrison's. It only has 585 pages, and you can see there's just about every word's important. So you end up highlighting just about every word, and you use the blank pages to write in additional lists of things. And at the back, you could tape in charts and things like that. So these condensed versions can be helpful, but it's still lengthy. So all kidding aside, this is our orthopedic Bible, Campbell's Operative Orthopedics, which actually has 3,800 pages. And then we have these other books like Current Diagnosis and Treatment to go along with these so that you can read about legal issues and malpractice. There's only a short section on that, unfortunately. And then every year there's an orthopedic knowledge update. This is number 9 to show. And each of these are lengthy, also 840 pages. And so good thing I have one of these. So there's a lot to learn. And we're anxious about missing something. So this becomes worse when you're in an emergency room situation and there's not much time to figure out what's wrong with the patient. So a lot of anxiety. And this leads to specialization. You see that there's a lot more specialists nowadays, and it's because there's too much to know in all of medicine. So we specialize. We're feeling pressured in that because of the economics, we're having to apply this sort of incomplete knowledge base that we have to more patients just to survive. And unfortunately, patients can start to be seen as revenue sources instead of as people with real problems. Part of this, we had the crash of 2009, and then the following year, we have Obamacare coming in with promises to spend a lot of money. As a result, you see physicians girding their practices and bolstering them in preparation for that big wave that I showed you earlier. So you've got shorter patient visits. You've got a lot more clinical work being done by mid-level practitioners like PAs. We have 4 of them now in our office. You're seeing private practice offices being absorbed by larger corporations. For example, in the peninsula, it's really hard to find a private practice physician who isn't either concierge or part of Stanford or the Palo Alto Clinic. Pretty much all of the private practice, internal medicine practices have been absorbed. And we have a big undersupply of physicians as a result. And that leads to a lot of dissatisfaction on the behalf of physicians and that same sense that the patients have that the system is somehow working against us. So ultimately, the patients and the physicians are really in the same boat. We're on the same team. We have the same dissatisfaction with the system. There's a dehumanization of medicine that's happening, and that's really our greatest threat. And the question is what to do about this. When we have the margin in the office to spend time with our patients and empathize with them and exhibit some of these adjectives that are being shown on the screen, we feel like the interaction has been more human. And the reverse is true when we don't have margin, when we're being pushed, we are overly engaged in our electronic devices. We've never been more overcommitted, but underconnected. And it's a scary thing, and it's very dehumanizing. And the patients feel it, and the physicians feel it. We don't always name it that, but that's what we're feeling. We're all feeling the same thing. So ultimately, you know, what are we going to do about it? So we're going to start first with the specialty model. We're going to talk about what we've done to change these pressures that we're feeling, and then we'll talk about whether or not that can be applied to the primary care model, and I really want to get your feedback on that. So starting with the specialty model, essentially what we've done, this is sort of my practice baseline from August of 1997 when I started practice. I joined a 7-member orthopedic group. It was basically a bunch of general orthopedists doing the whole gamut of orthopedics. We had 3 fellowship-trained junior partners. I was one of those. We had a sports medicine physician and a hand surgeon as well. But there's a lot of general orthopedics being done. Our production levels of all the partners was pretty equal but low, 30% nationwide and 50 percentile in California. We often argued about finances. When money is tight, you start to squabble over little things. And personality traits, the bad side of those things like greed and things like that, come out. And so we don't want times to be tight. We need to find ways to reduce pressure. So the big risk here is asking the big questions if we're going to make a change. And the questions for me are, what do I like and dislike about my specialty? And I love fixing patients' problems. I don't love seeing patients that I can't help. So those are sort of my that's what floats my boat and sinks my ship. And then you ask the question of what patients like and what they don't like. And my patients don't like sitting around in the waiting room. They don't like coming to see me and then ultimately realizing, wow, this guy can't really help me. I should have seen a hand surgeon, or I should have seen a sports medicine doctor. So I guess then you have to ask the question, is there a way for everybody to be happy? And the solution in our practice was really to pay attention to the answers to those questions. And first of all, putting only patients that I can help in my waiting room. Then I'm going to enjoy myself. Every patient I see, I can help. And the patients that I can't help aren't there. The key is to not put too many of those patients in your waiting room at one time, or now you've got waiting lists and things like that coming up again. The third is to remember that, you know, I trained as an orthopedic surgeon. I went off and did a fellowship in joint replacement. I'm trained as a joint replacement surgeon, so I should be that, since I spent all the time training for that, rather than being what necessarily the system forces me to be. So obviously there's a risk of potential loss of revenue when you say, you know what, I'm going to stop doing all types of orthopedics. Or if you're a cardiologist, you face the same thing. Every time you specialize, you worry, gosh, am I going to have enough patients to pay the bills? And that's a risk that you take. The line from the movie comes up, you know, if you build it, they will come. You hope that that's true, but you got to kind of wait and see. So let's talk about implementation. Essentially, what we did was getting the right patients in the waiting room. We talked a little bit about who are the right patients and who are the wrong patients. It's really the people I can help versus the people I can't help. The people that were in my waiting room in 1997 had all sorts of general orthopedic complaints, back pain, some with hip disease, a lot of patients with back pain. Why were they there? Because they were sent by their primary care doctor, who didn't spend any time screening them, just said, well, it sounds like an orthopedic issue. Go see the orthopedist. That's what their Harrison's textbook of medicine says to do. So that's why we were there. And the question is, how do you get from having, you know, the wrong patients in the waiting room to having the right one, right ones there? And the answer I mentioned before really is screening. So we need to screen our patients in some way. And screening is easy. I love Bizarro. That's a couple of good ones. I love Bizarro. screening is pretty easy. The key is to ask the right questions of the patient. You can do it over the phone. If you're talking about hip and knee arthritis, you can ask the patient, how long have you had your knee pain? If they say, well, I've had it a week, that's not going to be an arthritic knee. If they say, you know, I twisted my knee skiing, that's probably not an arthritic knee either. But if they say, well, it's been bothering me for a couple of years and it keeps getting worse and then it gets better and just going steadily downhill with some exacerbations, that's probably a patient with an arthritic knee. And so anybody who you can educate on this process can be the screeners. And we have great screeners in our office. Actually, one of them is sitting right there in the front row. So very simple to script out some simple questions to screen patients. You know, you can if you're an internist and you've got your advice nurse, if you're worried if a patient has a urinary tract infection, you can ask them, do you have burning when you urinate? You can ask them that over the phone so they don't have to come down to your office and tell you, oh, actually, I don't have burning when I urinate. I don't need to be here. So you screen them over the phone. And advice nurses have been doing that in internal medicine practices and pediatric practices for a long time. Certainly no reason not to do it in a specialty office. So our practice obviously has evolved because of this screening approach, trying to get patients who actually need us in the office. Our providers now, instead of seeing 30 or 40 patients a day, can see just over half that. We're finding that 95% of the patients that we see in the office actually need an operation. So our screeners are awesome. That basically helps us not to waste office visits, waste time in the office. If the results of the screening process are unclear, patients can be scheduled to see a mid-level practitioner, and often that diagnosis can be either confirmed or ruled out by the mid-level practitioner, and the patient can be referred accordingly. Our PAs in the office also help a lot with post-op follow-up visits, and we find that our office runs very much better and our patients wait a lot less time. So by addressing this office issue, we're able to restore margin for us and for our patients. The knowledge-based issue that I mentioned before, you know, there's too much to know. You don't have to know as much when you're a specialist. You can focus on that, and that allows you even more time and energy to focus on the specific nuances of your specialty and continue to advance that and do better surgery and take care of your patients better, as opposed to if you have to know it all, you're a jack of all trades and master of none, as they say. The economic pressure on our office was relieved by doing this approach because the surgical reimbursement is like 5 times what you would get paid for a simple office-based practice. So economics are favorable in this approach. And this approach is easily replicated for other specialties. You just have to come up with the screening questions. So this allows a surgeon to be a surgeon, and it certainly makes our patients happier too, because they're in the right place, and their visits go efficiently. So what about the hospital side, which is very, very important? Every inpatient specialty needs to partner with a hospital. The ideal setting would be one, especially for a program like ours, one where you're at the intersection of multiple freeways, which makes it easier for patients to access. You need to be distant enough from competition if you're going to be building a program that wasn't there before. You need a CEO and executive staff and board who are going to support that program and take risks along with the physicians, and you certainly need space to grow. The last 20 years, my strategic partner has been Washington Hospital in Fremont. It's a fantastic place to work. Many people have asked me why Fremont, and I've listed all those things that I mentioned earlier about the ideal place. It's well situated. We've got a very supportive CEO and executive staff. They've trusted us with a vision, which is an incredible gift, and you don't see that at every hospital. So we are very, very fortunate. So we looked at the various pieces of the program at Washington Hospital and tried to identify the pressures, as we've been talking about, in each place and to try and fix those. In the operating room, when you arrive at a new place and you look at your operating room, you'll see high turnover times between cases often. Often the staff might be inexperienced, which can lead to longer surgical procedures. You may see morale issues as part of the baseline at that hospital before change starts to be implemented. In our particular facility, we had very high implant costs that we were paying because there was only one implant company that was in the mix. There was no competition between the vendors. So the hospital was paying list prices for their implants, which is unheard of, but that's what was happening in 1997. So the question is how to affect change in an environment like that. I'm not actually the boss of the people that I'm going to be working with. So how do you do that? Well, obviously the hospital administration has to get behind the medical director and empower the medical director. The director needs to be working with and meeting with the leadership at the hospital to identify those areas that need to be changed or tweaked or completely overhauled. From my standpoint, I needed to be energetic to drive a program that didn't exist before, but I probably pushed that too much, and you need to have a humble leader as well, and it took me a while to learn that. I think my default was a little bit like this guy, who can be a little polarizing at times. He's very energetic and passionate, and he's done amazing things with every team that he's been involved with. We were a fan of his at Stanford, and he certainly did great things for the 49ers, and we're cheering him on at Michigan, where our daughter is now. But all passion and energy sometimes can burn out the people around you, and certainly trying to lead a joint replacement program that requires a team approach requires a humble spirit as well. So we looked at the costs for joint replacement in our program. The biggest piece was in the red, the operating room time and the supplies. The cost for the inpatient unit, you can see, is in green. That's a big piece as well. The implant cost in blue, another big piece. So those are the big three that were costing the hospital a lot of money. So obviously, in order to control costs, we have to develop some strategies, becoming more efficient, reducing the implant costs, shortening length of stays and things like that to get those costs down. And for us, an efficient operating room meant dedicated team concept, staffing it adequately so that the staff feels that they have margin, that they're not overworked, concentrating the surgical volume onto one day of the week and running two rooms instead of operating two different days in only one operating room. So when you operate in two rooms and you stagger them, you can do twice as many cases in a day. Condensing instrument plans and pans and really scripting the operation. So as a result of implementing some of these changes, going from one room to two rooms specifically, we essentially eliminated the turnover time that was between the cases. If you're staggering your rooms, you don't have to worry about how long it takes them to clean it because you're busy operating in the other room, and they can clean that room and get it ready for the next patient. So you can eliminate turnover time by running two operating rooms, by streamlining the instruments and being disciplined enough to script the surgery from A to Z. That reduced our case duration by 30%. And by bringing in a second implant vendor, it reduced our implant cost by 50% just by simple competition. So we now have much less expensive implants than we had 20 years ago. Of course, you have to be on this all the time in terms of maintaining that high morale. And the economics of it are a little bit mixed. I mentioned that we can do a lot more cases in a day, but there are some other issues that, like the rising cost of implants that tends to happen each year. Those list prices keep going up. The supply costs keep going up. The cost of the employees goes up every year. The cost of their healthcare benefits goes up every year. And we have a fixed reimbursement from Medicare from the DRG. So we have a fixed amount of money coming in, but rising costs. So we're always having to chase the costs. What about our care unit? What was wrong with it when we started out this program? Well, there wasn't one. We didn't have a program. We had a general orthopedic unit that kind of lacked purposes. The nurses had to manage a broad range of orthopedic conditions. The length of stays were long. The economics were relatively mediocre. And in order to create a more efficient unit, we isolated the program to a separate building. We developed care teams. We developed care pathways and shortened length of stay. Did group physical therapy, which helped to reduce redundancy of teaching. We instituted a teaching conference, which helped raise staff morale because we were interacting and we were all learning together. It creates a very smart team. It also allows us to troubleshoot what's happening on the unit in real time by meeting every week. So we also spent a lot of time looking at the staff attitude, and we have a wellness concept on the unit where just a real sense of positivity and outlook by the staff. Our patients constantly comment on that. And, you know, there's a difference between sort of being a concierge and being courteous versus actually loving people and being graceful. And we tend to push for the latter, going the extra mile, being humble and not glorifying ourselves while the patients are there, but just taking care of people. We developed a hip and knee database, which allows us to track our outcomes, which is very, very important, especially if you're going to present yourself to insurance companies. And the results of these changes have been growth, which leads to better outcomes. The more you do, the better you are, which, of course, leads to more growth because people hear about it. Our length of stay is shortened to just one day in the hospital for a hip or knee replacement. Partial knee replacements are typically done on an outpatient basis. And we have over 90% of our patients being discharged to home, which is very important for cost savings. The alternative would be sending a patient to a skilled nursing facility, which is much more expensive. And when this Medicare bundled payment process really gets going this next year, programs that have a heavy discharge to rehab facilities are going to be in trouble because rehab facilities are way more expensive than sending a patient home with home health care, a home physical therapist, for example. So this is really key. Obviously, our volume just went up and up and up and up and up, and I only have it till 2005 because I'd have to change the scale on the left. But the volume has gone crazy. Of course, with all of these changes, with the improved staff morale, et cetera, the pressures that people felt on the unit have been substantially relieved. The specialization for the staff, they know every step of the program. They know what's going to happen each day, so they don't have to worry about trying to remember, how do I care for a patient who had a hip or a knee replacement? They know it all by heart. The morale is high, as I mentioned, and the economics favorable, especially because of the high percentage of discharge to home and the short length of stays. We have a lot of outcome studies that we've done that are really fueled by our database. Our complication rates, fortunately, have been very low. Sites like HealthGrades love us. They give us their 5-star ratings and have called us a very safe place to do surgery. And currently, our patients are coming from all over the Bay Area, but a fair number coming from out of state. So after 18 years, we opened the program 18 years ago now. I brought my partner in 2008, and he's added a spark to the program and helped bolster the research end. They built us our new building, which we moved into in 2012. Our surgical volume is currently at over 1,500 cases per year. The year I started, I think they had done about 70 joint replacements that year. We're serving a lot of out-of-state patients, and as I mentioned, we're getting some pretty high ratings. I guess what we've learned is that patients will travel for a life-changing surgery, which is important if you're going to try and build a program. Yeah. So this was from Consumer Reports a couple summers ago, where Washington Hospital was rated as one of the top 5 places in the United States to have a hip replacement. Unfortunately, the 5 worst places are listed on the right. Mass General Hospital is where I did my fellowship. So this can work, as I said, for other specialty models and is already working for other specialty models. University programs have been successful in screening their patients for a long time, and there are other subspecialties that have a clear volume effect, such as cardiac surgery and eye surgery. So I'd like to finish our time with just a brief discussion about whether primary care can learn from this type of a model. The current models in primary care right now, concierge is one I'll talk about first. There's a lot to like about this model, and that it relieves all of those pressures that I was talking about, the financial and the economic ones for both the patient and the physician. So for the physician, they don't have as many patients, so they can get to know those really, really well. So they don't really need to cover all those diseases that they would if they were covering for 2,500 patients like most internists are. So it makes a lot of sense from that standpoint. The financial pressure on the physician is improved because they're getting a payment from their patients that are in the program every month. And patient and practitioner morale is universally high in this model. So a lot to like about it. I mentioned it is growing in popularity. There's about 6,000 concierge physicians in the United States now. Practice sizes vary from very small practices to larger, and the typical monthly fee is shown there, but it's quite variable depending on how many amenities you want and exactly how much access you want to have to your concierge physician. Obviously, the drawbacks I mentioned, there's a cost shift to patients in exchange for that improved access, which is not affordable by all. And as more physicians move into this model, which is happening more and more every year, the primary care pool is being depleted. A potential solution to this problem could be if the physicians were willing to increase their practice size up to 1,000 patients instead of 300 or 400 patients, and if they added a nurse practitioner or a PA like we've done, you might be able to get this sort of a model to work. For the non-concierge model, so what the rest of us are typically facing, the physicians are overworked. The primary care doctors are seeing between 2,500 and 4,000 patients each. There's a major shortage, obviously, in the physicians. Here's some numbers behind that. The Association of Medical Colleges is predicting a shortage by 2020 of 9,100 primary care physicians. Fortunately, medical school enrollment is up, but we can't guarantee that those doctors are going to go into primary care. There are a lot of physicians who are moving to concierge programs to cope with the pressures that we've talked about, and others are joining large entities, I'm expecting a drift toward a Kaiser-like model in the future for the non-concierge practices. The question is, can it be fixed? And just work with me for a minute. There's some numbers here. So our U.S. population of people over 25, so people who need a doctor, is about 182 million. Currently, there's 151,000 primary care doctors in the U.S. for the adult population. If a primary care doctor could handle 1,000 patients each, we would need 182,000 primary care doctors. So we're about 30,000 short. Okay. And obviously, we have to deal with the income loss. If you say to a doctor, well, you were caring for 2,500, now you're going to care for only 1,000, how are you managing that delta for the doctor? That's a big question. And then how do you incentivize med students to go into primary care and not do a specialty? And how you do that, we can talk about a little bit during the discussion. One thought I had is you forgive their loans for 5 years. You make loan payments for them if they stay in primary care. Without a fix, unfortunately, I think it's Kaiser for all, or most of us that can't afford concierge doctors. That Kaiser model basically mirrors the capitation model that we saw in the 1990s that failed in the non-Kaiser system. Capitation came and went. The captured patient premiums creates obviously a fixed total resource in the system, and so there's some inherent disincentive to spend money on patient care. And they do emphasize prevention and wellness pretty heavily. We grew up in the Kaiser system. My parents are still in the Kaiser system. And the advantages, obviously, it's a large system of hospitals allowing a lot of money saved due to group purchasing. They do a lot of data collection, which allows cost-benefit analysis, which they can apply regularly. They do offer generous starting salaries for physicians exiting a training program, so it's attracting a lot better physicians than they were able to attract, say, 20 years ago. Obviously, there's some downsides. There's a potential loss of control of the care process for patients, which can be a little frustrating, such as for my mom, who's facing some health struggles in Kaiser right now. You lose your ability to have any sort of legal retribution when you sign up for Kaiser. You agree to have your cases decided by a different process. Sometimes managing illnesses require more advocacy, and screening may be enhanced by patients taking the initiative. I want to just talk a second about self-screening, and then we'll close. I think if we as patients can become a bigger part of the care process, it would be helpful, whether you're in a Kaiser system or some other system. Devices such as home blood pressure monitoring, using some tools from the internet that we'll look at briefly, and some of the other options out there help us to be more part of the process, and we can screen ourselves before we call our doctor or go into the doctor's office, which will help save time. So if you look at your wrist and you've got a bump on your wrist like that, you know, you can go to the internet, for example, and type in to Google bump on the wrist, and you'll see a little picture and you say, yeah, that's what I have. And if you make a mistake and you type in tumor on the wrist because you thought you wanted to be more specific, you'll still see that it's a benign condition, and then you'll end up going to this hand surgery site, which tells you you actually have a ganglion cyst. It's not a tumor. But eventually, if you look close enough, you'll find Dr. Oz's site, where he calls it a Bible bump and recommends hitting it with a large book. Historically, the largest book in the household was the Bible. Mine only weighs about 3.2 pounds. My Harrison's textbook of medicine weighs 14 pounds. And I showed you that the Harrison's is really thick, and my Bible's not nearly as thick, so I'd probably hit it with Harrison's. You can use the edge of a laptop computer, apparently. That's a picture from the internet, somebody trying to smash it. You can have the Pope involved. Maybe that's why they call it a Bible bump. The Pope is trying to bless the patient there. Or you can take try and drain it yourself at home. Kind of scary. If you have something more complicated like pancreatitis, though, now you're in trouble because all you know is you have abdominal pain. You don't know what your diagnosis is. So you type it into Google, and you look for abdominal pain, and you see the first site there is WebMD, and you see it's complicated. You're going, well, now I do have to read about each of these things to see what I have. All I have is abdominal pain. And if you go to the Merck Manual site, you see sort of this diagram over here, and you go to Medline. Oh, now you see what the organs are, so maybe I can figure out, based on where the pain is, what I'm having. The site I like is the Mayo Clinic, because you can choose a symptom, and then you can go down the list. Well, shoot, it's gnawing. It's made worse by certain foods. It's also made worse by sudden movements. And you get to the end, you see, oh, pancreatitis is number one. And then you can call your doctor and say, I think I have pancreatitis. And they may tell you to go away. The problem is if you're just feeling tired because you've had pancreatitis for a long time, and a family member of ours has it, so I'm using pancreatitis. If you're just feeling tired and you tell your doctor, well, I'm tired, they're not going to know you have pancreatitis. We were taught in medical school to listen to the patient. They're telling you the diagnosis. And that's true, except when they aren't. Except when they don't know which symptom is the important one. So none of these tools replace seeing your doctor. So I want to just underscore that. And last thing, I wanted to show this useful tool, which I used a lot, and I had my mom use it. It's a tool by AliveCor. It's basically an EKG app for your iPhone. And there's an electrode that you hold and that you put behind your phone. You can attach it to the back of your phone, and you'll get your EKG tracing. And when you get your EKG tracing, it'll tell you if you have atrial fib, if you're in sinus rhythm. And then you can actually email it to your doctor and say, well, you know that thing I was having? Here, I'm having it, and here's my EKG strip. So this is a great tool. But these don't replace visits to your doctor. So I think I'll quit there, and
let's
have some discussion and questions.
I'm going to answer this first one because this is easy. How can we get a copy of tonight's recording? This was being recorded. It's a podcast. It'll be up on the Commonwealth Club site in a couple days. And also, just for those listening at home, you said, Dr. Dearborn, about 9,150 short, and the slide said actually 91,000.
Yeah, we're 30,000 short in terms of 30,000 short in terms of primary care doctors. Are you saying that?
Yeah, one of the slides, right? It said the slide said 91,500 short, but you said
9,100. Sorry.
Is it 9,100 or 91,000?
91,000.
Okay, there
That's
you go.
That's the physician shortage by 2020,
okay.
Primary care doctors.
Just wanted to...
91,000.
Okay, so we answered that one. So here's a question. And we'll take a few questions, but like I said earlier, we'll have to wrap up in a few minutes, and then we can ask more after the program. Okay, the U.S. has twice the per capita cost of health care, but ranks low on many measures of health. How can this change? And just as brief as you can, since we have quite a few questions.
Yeah, I mean that there's a huge issue. You know, we're not necessarily using our healthcare dollars efficiently. So you saw the massive amount of money being spent by Medicare. And if you this wasn't not enough time today to talk about the fact that the vast majority of that money is being spent in the last few years of life. So how we're allocating our healthcare resources probably needs to be looked at. Unfortunately, it's a very difficult process to do that and say, well, okay, you with this condition, you don't need that money, but this person over here does. And so it's a really, really tough one.
Okay. The next question is, will the U.S. get single-payer health card? Single-payer health care, sorry, i.e., and again, I think it says new insurance companies.
Yeah, so there's my crystal ball. You know, are we going to have single payer? I'm not sure we want single payer. It depends on who's running it. You know, right now, Medicare has not been run like an insurance company. And I dished insurance companies earlier showing you their massive profits and how they're not paying for physicians and they're not paying hospitals. But I think if we ran Medicare a little bit more like an insurance plan, in other words, you don't get care from Medicare if you didn't pay in, or you've got some compensation for that if you join Medicare, but you've got a lot of medical issues. Maybe your premiums are higher. I think you gotta tweak the system for sure. But the question is, who's running it? And I'm leery about having our federal government run an insurance company, given that it doesn't seem to be able to do a lot of things efficiently.
Okay. I don't know what, I'm curious to see what this actually means. What is the, quote, insurance tail in California? T-A-I-L.
Are you talking about malpractice insurance tail?
Whoever wrote that, that's what you mean? Okay.
You want to know the dollar amount? I don't know the answer to that.
No, I want to know the year amount.
The year amount?
State.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. That's a really good question. Yeah.
I think you've already answered this one. What do you think of a single-payer system for the U.S. healthcare system?
I like the concept of single-payer. The question is, who's going to run it? And we need to have, there needs to be some business sense behind it, but we also need some compassion there. And you got to mirror those two together, and not sure quite how to do that.
Okay. What is currently the safest and longest-lasting knee artificial, again, I'm sorry, some your handwriting's, I'm struggling here. Longest-lasting knee, whatever, artificial knee. What is the longest-lasting or artificial knee? I would like to know which one by name as is the best implant for women in their 60s. Have you been, and I can't read the last paragraph. Hopefully you've got
so,
the,
yeah, so we're going this. Nobody knows which knee is the best. The fact is, if you're talking about knee replacement implants, it's pretty much Dodge, Ford, Chevy, not to insult people who just love Fords and would never buy a Chevy. There is not one that stands head and shoulders above the others. There are a lot of marketing claims which have no science. You know, for a while, Smith Nephew was saying that we have a knee that lasts, it's the 30-year knee. And they said it was a 30-year knee because in the lab, they took their polyethylene and they rubbed a pin of cobalt chrome, which is what the femoral component is made out of. They rubbed it against the plastic. And at a certain number of cycles per second, and they simulated this many years of use because we know how many knee cycles that you go through per year. They decided it was going to last 30 years. They called it a 30-year knee. And at some point, the government decided that they could not say they had a 30-year knee because they did lab testing with a pin on disc. So there's not a consensus on which one's the best one. Otherwise, we'd all be using it.
Okay. Lately, practices are charging a lot more. Stanford hearing test is $265 for a 35 appointment by a technician, used to be $95. Patients do not have control over the billing. Exclamation mark. Somebody's upset about billing.
Yeah. You know, and if you look at the billings for procedures, oftentimes there's what's billed and then there's what's paid. And sometimes the contracts might be based on a percentage of billed charges. And I'm sure that's true for Stanford as anywhere else. We have a Stanford professor in the back of the room who could probably talk about whether they charge more than other places do. But it sounds like actually a pretty good bargain because I had to get a hearing test done and I had to pay more than that at a private place. So.
Okay, this handwriting is tough, but I think I might get most of it. How do you deal with associated care, physical therapy, lab, drugs, etc. in a
concierge?
Really? Concierge system.
Yeah, so there are a lot of different types of concierge systems, but most of them, the way it goes is you have your insurance plan, whether it's Medicare or whatever else, and you can use that insurance plan, all the benefits of that insurance plan, but then you pay your concierge doctor $200, $300, $400, $500 a month for direct access to them. So all the concierge payment goes to is to that primary care doctor who's taking care of you. And then all of your other tests and hospitalizations and things like that are funded by whatever insurance plan you're currently carrying. So the concierge... Yes, you pay for both. You add to what you're currently paying for your insurance plan. You add $200, $300, $400 a month or whatever it is. And there are some concierge physicians. I actually sent an email out to every concierge doctor I know in preparation for this talk to get a sense from them. And there are some that will bill for you and will actually get reimbursement from the visits from the doctor visit. And they'll actually charge you less per month because they're actually billing for the services that they provide you. And there are some that don't do that and they charge you a little bit more. It's a little bit variable. So you want to talk to your doctors. But if you have a doctor you like, I had it on my last slide. If you have a doctor you really like and you're frustrated with the wait times and things like that, you could ask them, hey, would you ever consider a concierge model? A lot of them are considering it. But when if you convince your doctor to go concierge, somehow you have to convince another three or four med students to go into primary care because you're taking away from the primary care pool.
Okay, last question. Do you ascertain micronutrient levels prior to surgery as well as inflammation markers? If so, do they affect surgery outcomes?
Oh, that's a great question. We don't do that routinely. When we're looking at doing revision surgeries, for example, we will look at inflammatory markers because sometimes if inflammatory markers are elevated, it could mean that the implant that we're about to redo is actually infected. So we do a lot more work with inflammatory markers in the revision setting, but we don't do it routinely.
Okay. Well, that's the last question. Just stay right there while I knock the gravel. It's not gravel. It's a gavel. Okay. Well, a big thank you to Dr. John Dearborn. We can clap now.
Yay!
For your comments here today, we also thank our audiences here as well as for those listening to the recording. And now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating the 109th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned. Nice. That was awesome.